I'll call a Senate Committee on Commerce to order, and what we're going to do is just a couple of things. We have four different bills that we have on our agenda for today. We have a public hearing that we will be doing secondary Senate Bill 194. For anyone that's here today on Senate Bill 139, we are not going to be hearing that this afternoon. We've got some issues that we need to still work through. So if you're here for the work session on 139, it's not going to happen today. Today being Thursday, do we want to go ahead and just carry this over to, can we be ready on Tuesday or should we wait?
Yes, we can be ready on Tuesday.
All right. What I want to do is go ahead and just carry over Senate Bill.
Actually, we should carry it over till Thursday.
Of next week?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to open work session for Senate Bill 139 for the purpose of stating that we're going to be carrying over Senate Bill 139 to a week from today, which should be April 7th, I believe. And it will be a week from today, whatever date that is, but I believe it's April 7th. And we'll close the work session on 139. At this point, we're going to do two quick work sessions, or hopefully quick, because I'm getting ready to lose some of my members because of other commitments. So we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 118.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 118 is the homeowners insurance bill, and we had a work group on this bill, and I know that there's late breaking news on what's going on with this work group and the latest amendments. The Dash 5 amendments are in front of you, and I was just told that those aren't actually the most relevant amendments. The relevant amendments are the Dash 4s now, which you got in the staff report. So maybe we could have the representative of the work group up to address what's going on with this bill.
Like late breaking news. Okay. And who's coming forward from the work group?
Myself, two insurers, a consumer representative, and a realtor representative.
Okay, that would be great. The only caution I have, if we can get right to the focus of what we need to deal with, because I know that Senator Burdick has to step out shortly. And then Greg.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Joel Ario, insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. What you have in front of you in the Dash 4s today, the Dash 4s through Senate Bill 118, is the consensus version of the homeowner bill. I'm happy to report that all interested stakeholders are on board the bill now. The only issues we have remaining are some technical issues in the drafting of the Dash 4s, but we have agreement from all parties on those four issues, which I'll enumerate in a moment, to take care of them in the House, since we've assembled all the parties today and clearly have the consensus, and we're dealing with technical drafting issues, not substantive issues. So if you want, I can summarize briefly where we are on the substance, but I have the sense you want me to move quickly to the technical issues of what you need to approve today. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, basically what we want to do is put on the record what the overview of the Dash 4s, which I understand is the consensus of the working group, understanding that we have a few technical issues that did not get captured in the Dash 4s, and then I want to just make certain that the interested parties are willing to move the bill forward with the understanding that those technical fixes will be done on the House side.
That's correct. Do you need me to enumerate the technical issues, or
I'm going to leave that really to the panel. If you think it needs to be on the record, we can do that. But it sounds to me that it being technical doesn't seem like of substance. It is of substance, but something that we need to.
Let me just say two words on each of them, and then okay. I think that'll do it for everybody. We need to change the definition of homeowners insurance to make sure that owners' interest in rental or commercial exposures is not covered by the bill. We need to change the section dealing with the five-year look back for purposes of application and renewal to make it clear that it's from the renewal point as well as from the initial application point, whichever applies. We need to go back to the definition of mitigation that was in a prior draft, and we need to change one reference to address to make it consistent with the other uses of the word address, last known address. Those are the four technical changes we need to make in the House, and I believe on that basis everybody is fine with the substance of the bill.
Okay. And Mr. Oxley, do you want to just Put on the record your...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gary Oxley, Oxley & Associates, appearing before you this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Realtors. The Realtors have reviewed the work product that the group has done, and we find it to be very satisfactory. We think the group has produced a very good product.
And, sorry, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Shaw, Vice President of Personal Lines for Liberty Northwest, and as part of the work group that worked on this since inception, I think Administrator Ario has outlined the four issues that we'd like to address, and with that, we'd have full support.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. I agree with Commissioner Ario on the four areas we've identified. This has been pretty much a year-long process for me working with the insurance division. I think we're on the verge of a workable bill from a conceptual standpoint. There are those technical issues. The only thing I would like to put on the record is we've had limited circulation now of the bill, and there could be other technical issues, but they will be technical and not conceptual.
Okay. That's fair. I guess the chair would like to take the time to just, one, thank everyone that has been a participant in the work group process. I know this is something that's important, and we'll get someone else up. So whoever else wants to come up, I just think that this is from a corroborative method of dealing with these type of issues, and hopefully that you know, we'll be able to continue that in other ventures.
Hi. Thank you, Senator Prozanski and members of the committee. I'm Greg Ledbetter, here as a representative from SEIU Union. I should disclose that I also work for the insurance division, but I'm on vacation leave right now and as a representative of a subcommittee or an ad hoc committee from SEIU. And I want you to know that we do support the bill. We think this is a good bill, and we think it's been through a good process, and we do support it.
Great. Any other comments that we would like to put on the record?
Two brief thank yous. One to your esteemed committee administrator for driving a hard process here and getting us to agreement at times when it would have, might have taken us a lot longer if she hadn't been kind of cracking the whip for you. And then John Paul, I don't usually single out lobbyists like John, but at a couple key junctures here, he brought the technical people in that helped us solve some of the technical problems here, and I think he serves a mention for that.
Thanks. Well, you can see the gray hair I'm getting. It's because of the workforce over here. So thank you very much. And I guess if there's not anything else, we'll go ahead and take care of the business that we have. And again, I thank everyone that's participated in this process.
Thank you.
Senator Beyer, would you like to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are in work session?
Yes, we are.
I move the Dash 5 amendment.
Dash 4.
All right.
I've
got a Dash 5.
Yeah.
Those are new. Disregard.
Okay. They're new and we don't like them?
Yeah, right.
The consensus will go away if we go with the fines. I just have to say it won't be kumbaya.
I was at 4 minutes into Senate Bill 118. Apologize.
That's quite all right. Senator Byers moved for the adoption of the Dash 4s into Senate Bill 118. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 118 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Barr moves Senate Bill 118 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Not hearing any. It's so ordered. Senate Bill 118 as amended with the Dash 4s will go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I'll go ahead and carry this one.
Normally, later versions are more correct.
So, again, thank you. Let's see. The other one that we were going to address was Senate Bill 142. So I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 118. At the same time, I'm opening up a work session on Senate Bill 142.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 142 makes failure to pay support enforcement division money held pursuant to a support enforcement order an unlawful deduction. We heard this on March 1st. There was testimony in favor and neutral testimony. We have a Dash 1 amendment and that deletes the requirement that the employer pay the employee in trust for the holder of the support rights. And we have a Dash 2 amendment that requires that the money be recovered to reimburse the cost of enforcing this bill. I just spoke with Cisco, and there will be a small cost to this bill, and I believe that that Bowley would like it to be referred to Ways and Means. You might want to ask them.
And Annette, if you would be so kind, I understand that the department has made a decision that it would, in fact, like, instead of having this bill move forward to the floor, even though it only has a small fiscal, to have it actually move into Ways and Means for deliberation.
Mr. Chair, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I have since checked with the commissioner, and he believes that we would actually go ahead and see it sent through the process. We do have discretion to decide to take certain unlawful deduction claims or not, so if the workload got too great, we could come back to you and try to minimize our workload and work very hard with technical assistance and compliance efforts to get employers to do the right thing up front. So we are concerned enough about this practice that we would go ahead and move the bill forward and address that internally with our workload and our administrative rules.
Okay, just to make sure I'm on the same page, basically what the department wants us to do is go ahead and move this bill into the Ways and Means process.
No, Mr. Chair, move it forward to the Senate floor. I'm sorry.
To the floor. Okay, I apologize.
That's okay.
So
I'm not very clear.
We're going to move it forward at this point, and I'm going to ask if anyone has any questions at this point, since what I stated earlier seems to be not where we need to go or where we want to go. So is there any questions for the Ms. Talbot?
Mr. Chair, I don't know, but someone needs to speak to me about the Dash 2 amendments, because I don't recall. At the first committee hearing, I recall there was a discussion of the Dash 1 amendments, which does, as I had highlighted on my bill, as we're supposed to do, but the Dash 2 amendments appear to be new to me.
Mr. Chair, if I might, or would you like to do it?
Okay.
The Dash 2 amendments were an attempt to minimize the fiscal, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, so that as we have authority in other aspects of our wage and hour chapter, that we could take the any civil penalty that we were to assess and apply it to our costs first before we would send anything on to the Common School Fund, which I believe is where all of our other penalties go. So that would minimize the fiscal amount for us to the extent that there is one. As the fiscal, which I'm sorry you don't have, but the fiscal we sent to the Legislative Fiscal Office did indicate that we would not be wanting to assess penalties to employers who, once contacted by us, were willing to send the money forward. So that is not our goal, is to get the money to the right place, not to assess the penalty. Plus, that minimizes our workload in terms of the investigation as well. So our first goal would be to send them a letter saying, you know, we have information that suggests there might be this problem and ask them to remedy it. If not, then we would proceed on, and if we had to assess a civil penalty and use that to cover our costs for that case.
Senator Beyer, any other follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the Dash 2, I'm concerned about those. It's I don't like the policy that we give agencies the ability to go out and find people so they can pay for their services. I personally have a concern with the Dash 2 amendments, the Dash 1 amendments to the bill. We have to move forward with the Dash 2. I don't think I can support it.
Mr. Chair, if I might, Senator Beyer, I do know that that is a longstanding legislative concern, having worked in the building years ago. We only are allowed to apply the civil penalty to the case in question, so we can't just sort of capture the civil penalty and apply it to the cost of the whole program. So, as I said, we would attempt mightily to make sure that employers comply once they're notified to avoid the civil penalty. Our goal is to get the money to the right place, since these parents are trying to pay their support, and that is our goal. Our goal at this point is to not get the civil penalties at all, is to just get compliance.
I also would have trouble with the Dash 2 for the same reason, and it doesn't have to do with the goals. It has to do with the plain language of the law.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and carry Senate Bill 142 over until next Tuesday, so that would be
Thursday.
So we'll carry Senate Bill 142 over to next Thursday, April 7th.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 142. Thank you, Senator Burdick.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 194. And I have a list here of individuals who are going to be speaking. And it looks like, Annette, you're back up. And I'm going to, based on the positions that have been checked. I'll ask Ernest, is it Delazano?
Damaso.
Sir, please come on up. And John Shaw. And Ms. Tyler, if you'd like to go ahead and get started while the other two are coming up.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 194. This legislation was introduced at the request of the Senate Interim General Government Committee to investigate how injured workers fare after sustaining a job-related injury. We know that despite many improvements in the occupational and safety and health area, that injured workers, that workers still get injured on the job. And we have a system in the workers' compensation system that clearly says that its goal is to return the injured worker to both physically and economically to the state they were in pre-injury. And that's a laudable goal. And the system does stress the continuity of employment so that an injured worker can try to return to their job at injury if possible and at least return to work somewhere given their current physical condition. There is a cost to society if injured workers aren't returned to work. And that's one of the reasons why the state law prohibits discrimination against injured workers. The Bureau does currently enforce the Injured Worker Discrimination Law, and it is a complaint-based law, and we do receive funds from the Workers' Benefit Fund to enforce that discrimination law. Approximately 15% of our caseload in the Civil Rights Division relates to injured workers. I have some preliminary data that we have run from our antiquated data system on our closed cases, and we have approximately 1,200 cases in the last 5 years related to injured workers. Of those, 726 approximately were related to injured worker discrimination alone. And out of those, approximately 17% were found to have merit by the Bureau or were settled privately. And an additional 17% were withdrawn to court, indicating that the parties were going to litigate the issues instead of continue through the administrative process. Interestingly, injured worker claims also are often dual filed with disability claims as well as family leave claims, since an injured worker can be qualified under the state disability law as a serious disability that affects a major life activity, or it can relate to a serious health condition for qualifying for the Family Leave Law Act. At the current time, the Bureau is only funded to do a complaint-based investigation of these injured worker complaints. And we often hear that there is a broader systemic problems in terms of getting injured workers back to work, that they experience discrimination, but that it is very difficult to prove, and that we do not have sufficient staff currently to investigate some of the issues that are brought to our attention, and I believe Ernie will address some of those as well. We would like to have the committee consider the Bureau working collaboratively with the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Injured Worker Ombudsman Office to develop a system to improve the coordination of services to injured workers and to develop more educational resources for both workers and employers to make sure that they're aware of the anti-discrimination laws and how the disability and the family leave laws also interplay with the injured worker law. The Workers' Comp Division has done numerous studies over the past decade to look at the impacts of changes in the workers' comp system, and we believe that this is an area that deserves further study as well. None of the studies to date have looked at this particular issue of how injured workers fare after they sustain a work-related injury in terms of how they may or may not be discriminated against based on their injured worker status, or how they actually just fare in terms of returning to work. We believe the study would be complementary to the current studies Workers' Comp is doing with vocational assistance and return to work, And obviously a key effectiveness indicator of a workers' comp system and a return to work program is what happens to the workers when they are able to return to work. And notably, the use of some of these return to work programs and vocational assistance have fallen off over the last several years. So that is a concern as well. The Bureau has been working with DCVS to amend the bill. As you see, the Dash 1 amendments, they focus the intent of the study in terms of particular areas, and we appreciate their assistance and the assistance of the Ombudsman Office in trying to focus the study. During the study, we hope to create a more structured communication process now so that injured workers who call the Ombudsman Office don't have to repeat their whole story about what's happened to them to another state agency when they talk about their discrimination. So we could do some staff-to-staff training and coordination and communication that we think that would be helpful to all parties, including the injured worker especially. You have before you, in addition, a study from Texas. While we understand that each state's workers' compensation system is very different, the Texas study does have some interesting findings. The most interesting findings I've tried to outline for you, over 21% of the injured workers surveyed in their study were fired or laid off after their injury. While the report notes that this was not necessarily because they filed for a workers' compensation, it did provide some insight into how these injured workers fared. Interestingly, again, those who were discouraged were reported by, based on a survey in the study, from using the workers' compensation system. 25% of them were fired or laid off after they reported their injury to their employer that had discouraged them from filing a claim in the first place, compared to only 12% who were never fired after they filed their complaint. In addition, obviously, these individuals who weren't able to return to work are more reliant on public assistance and have a harder time becoming reemployed. There are obviously many variables that impact how a worker can and can return to work, and the Texas study provides a lot of good literature and research on what Oregon would need to look at to make sure that they're comparing things and making an analysis of the types of employers these workers work for, the unemployment rates, the workers' level of education, and the extent of their impairment. This study would be funded out of the Workers' Benefit Fund, and which is another fund source, and we are currently working with the department to determine what other studies they've conducted to look at the amount of funds that were required for similar studies so that we can get a handle on what type of fiscal, so that you would know what the impact to the Workers' Benefit Fund would be. We do believe in the long run that Oregon would be better off having a study to make informed decisions about what's the impact of an injury to an injured worker. Injured workers are often said to suffer two injuries. First, the injury on the job, and second, the discrimination they face when trying to find a new job. And that is something that I think the society and the system and the legislature and policymakers would be better off to know how that plays out as their injury and their healing comes forward after their on-the-job injury. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm sure Ernie will add some comments to the study.
Just for the record, it was my understanding of reviewing the Dash ones, they were really, quote-unquote, a rewrite of the original bill, giving it a little bit more focus, narrowed to the areas that you've testified. Is that correct?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. The department and the Bureau worked together to make it clear that we weren't having any trouble in terms of how people were handling the work that each of us were doing. It was just really to get a better handle on the kinds of policy decisions we might need to make if we had more informed information.
Great. Thank you. Please.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Ernie Del Mazzo, and I'm the volunteer executive director of Injured Workers Alliance. Senate Bill 194, I repeat, Senate Bill 194 will be funded through the Workers' Benefit Fund, which is separate and distinct from the general fund. WBF funding is provided through a premium assessment paid by employers and employees alike at 1.7 cents each for each hour, partial hour worked. the ending fund balance for fiscal year 2004 was over $171.5 million. I've attached their documentation to that effect. In 2004, WBF expenditures in the non-complying employer program had a net cost of $1.9 million, excluding unknown collection costs. And we realize that workers are helped by receiving legally mandated benefits, but Oregon law requires that employers have coverage. When you look at WBF expenditure, you see that much of it is funded where it should be, through premiums and not through the workers' benefit fund. We feel that it's therefore not unreasonable to seek less than 1% of the fund balance to make sure that Oregon laws are complied with. While Boley has received WBF funding only since 2003, and I cite the statute, the amount allocated is a pittance and sorely inadequate. Over 6.5 years of communications with injured workers several times a week, we find that discrimination is a serious problem. This data is from 2 years ago, but an average of 2,500 complaints were filed annually with Boley's Civil Rights Division, and 21% at that time involved injured worker discrimination. We believe that these are categorized, as Boley stated, under various categories. And so basically, this probably dilutes the percentage, both the 15% stated and even this 21%. Another problem is that workers simply aren't aware of their rights relating to discrimination and the procedure for filing complaints. And we believe Senate Bill 194, due to its educational benefits, could remedy this. The sharing of information between DCBS, including the Ombudsman for Injured Workers, and Boley, when specific civil rights abuses can be documented further, is restricted by current law. Basically a privacy issue, even though the worker may want to relinquish that. I do cite some statistical information under there. Oregon law prohibits an employer from rejecting a job applicant for past workers' compensation claims, but the law is meaningless due to a lack of enforcement funding. In most instances, employers are not supposed to ask before offering a job whether the applicant has any impairment that would prevent them from performing their job. Yet we know of instances where pre-employment screening companies have detailed information, and I do mean very detailed, regarding a worker's compensation claim. In fact, the state discovered that a contractor it was using was providing detailed claim histories for price, even though they weren't legally entitled to. And DCBS, Mr. Schultz is here, and I'm sure he can explain how that happened. Perhaps more than any other state, Oregon workers' compensation laws, the system's oversight or lack thereof, and employment demographics parallel those of Texas. In fact, when you see workers' compensation laws, each state borrows from the other quite routinely. The state council, which is now part of the Texas Department of Insurance, studied the injured worker discrimination in the same report that Boley cited. She cited some of the numbers I provided, but I'd like to add a few others. 7% of injured workers surveyed said they were threatened with being fired after being injured on the job. Over one quarter, 26% of laid-off workers were let go from their jobs within 1 week of reporting their injury. In actually 13% of these cases, the action took place the same day the employee reported the injury. We believe the Texas State study clearly indicates a problem, including a situation which you see there where twice as many workers in percentile were let go after being discouraged from filing a workers' comp claim compared to those who weren't discouraged. lack of communication and cooperation between Boley and DCBS, which we're finally seeing a little bit of, and meager funding, especially to Boley, to combat civil rights violations against the disabled, has encouraged unlawful practices. I might add that 2 years ago, you're probably going to hear arguments from some people that there isn't a problem. These same arguments were made about the IME issue. And as we know now, through both the IME study and through media attention, widespread media attention, that it's a serious problem. Unfortunately, I feel that too many workers will be harmed in perhaps 2 years where we might see legislation. We also have a situation where MLAC has a history of compromise or making its decisions cost neutral. I just can't see how you can make discrimination against injured workers either of those, unless perhaps if you said that they were allowed to discriminate against X percentage of workers legally, which would be the way MLAC usually works. We believe this is a serious problem. We are pretty certain that Oregon has never studied the discrimination issue. Again, we're aware of many instances where employers discourage workers from applying for workers' compensation benefits. And again, you know, Boley is responsible for many things, including enforcing rights involving employee reinstatement. And ORS 659A, with the funds they have, that just can't be done adequately. We simply want a tiny percentage of the $171+ million balance to protect injured workers. And because that employers who violate our laws receive substantially more than we believe this covers, when in fact, you know, they're duty bound and the state is obligated to pay these benefits because of the, you know, workers giving up their right to sue, we feel that it's only fair that workers are provided this chance, and that we do hope that committee members support Senate Bill 194 and allow protections accorded under Oregon and federal law to be enforced. And I do thank you for this opportunity to defend workers, and I can answer any questions you have.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair, a couple, I guess. First, I don't see anywhere in here where an amount is given on what it's going to cost to do a study. And I know it says the Bureau and the DCBS will enter an interagency agreement and, you know, blah, 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 but I don't even see an estimate. And maybe it's in staff, and we're going to have a credit close now. The cost. Okay. Does anyone have an estimate?
Yeah, Ms. Talbot.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner. Senator Beyer, we are working with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to try to identify what the costs of other studies they have done are. We had initially done a fiscal, which I'm searching for. Because of the way the statute is written currently, we do have an interagency agreement with DCBS. And the way the bill is amended, amending 659040, we could just add an amount of money for the study to that. The DCBS has asked us, however, as understandably, to give them a cap of what they think the highest would be. So we are working with them. We had initially estimated about $300,000 for the first biennium and closer to $400,000 for the second biennium. Obviously, that has caused some concern among the management members of MLAC, which we did present this to. So we will go back to work with DCBS to find out what the other studies they have done and what they've cost. Clearly, these would be limited duration positions that we would have. They're not permanent positions that we would bring on. Our initial idea for the study was to have a longitudinal kind of study where you could actually watch what happens to the workers over time and survey them as they are going through the process, as opposed to what Texas did, was just look back in time and survey workers whose claims were closed and had already gone through the system. They also only surveyed injured workers and not employers, which I think was a mistake. That I think as a neutral law enforcement agency, I think you have to hear both sides of the issue before you can really reach an informed decision. So if we were to do a survey as an instrument and only do pass files, that would be a more limited study, and I think we could keep the cost down. But if we want a more on-the-ground kind of in-person study over time, I think it would cost more, about the numbers that I initially gave you.
Ms. Talbot, I think what I'm going to ask, because it sounds like this is a working process.
It is, Mr. Chair.
So why don't you all get together, figure out what the cost of the studies would be, and that way you can bring it back and we can see what, if any, parameters we think were appropriate or necessary. Realizing, I don't know if this would require to be referred to Ways and Means based on the cost of the study. It sounds like it wouldn't, from what I'm hearing. But I think that's a fair question, so we kind of know where we're at and what we're going to do.
There is a subsequent referral, I believe.
There is. All right.
There could be, Mr. Chair. Like I say, the way the bill has been rewritten at the suggestion of DCBS, we could just add an amount on to our interagency agreement. But clearly, everyone wants to know what amount are we talking about.
Yeah, it would seem to me that when you make that determination as to what the study is going to be and what the cost is, someone's going to need to talk, because right now we've got the subsequent referral based on the original bill, I assume, not on the dash ones. Or is that?
That's true, but so, I don't think that's changed much. I think that's
right. We're going on the premise at this point it's going to Ways and Means, unless there's something that shows, not shows to us, but basically the leadership and Ways and Means says it's changed significant enough that it doesn't have to. So. Do you have any thoughts as to when y'all might be in the position to come back before us?
Just talk with Mr. Savage about getting some information from DCBS about the other studies they've done so we could compare the surveys that they've done. So I hope to be able to do that early next week.
Okay, here's the situation. I'm going to go ahead and, I've got one more person. Mr. Wilson's here in a neutral position. We're going to take his testimony. We're going to close the hearing unless there's someone else after that. And then we'll just have it set for next Thursday.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If we're going to do something on it, we need to have it set. You know, we'll have it set for them, but we'll need to have that information before then.
Mr. Chair, I guess for my purposes, if we determine a study like this needs to be done, first, I think, you know, that's one decision that needs to be made. Second, is Boley the right place to do it? I personally would say no. It's a workers' comp issue. I think the DCBS, if we need to do a study, DCBS probably should be the agency that commissions the study or does the study through the workers' comp division. And thirdly, then, if we determine it's going to be and it's going to be workers' comp, I would prefer to see it be an independent study, not done by agency, but to hire an outside firm to do it, or at least find out what that would cost in comparison to an in-house study. I mean, I think those are all other ways, I guess, to skin the cat, you might say, if you get by the first hurdle that you determine a study needs to be done. As far as the testimony by DeMazzo, you know, you have one statement here that you said 13% of the cases an injury and action took place in the same day. And I guess I'd like to point out that from my experience as an employer, I think that's probably accurate, but what happens is I give notice of the last day of seasonal work, and that happens to be the day that I get most injuries.
I believe if you look at the study summary, you'll find that certain workers were excluded, and I'm almost certain I read that farm workers were excluded. Well, could be wrong, but reviewing the summary should answer that.
Well, and I haven't reviewed the summary. I appreciate that, but I don't think that would be...
There could be a rational reason for that, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think that would be only farm workers. That it's just, I mean, it's just, I know from my own personal experience that, and in fact, you know, if you notify people that as of next Friday we're going out of work, it just so happens that on Thursday or Friday that I almost always have an injury that day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just is a cause and effect. And they've worked for me for 6 weeks, and all of a sudden the last day of employment,
Mm-hmm. They get injured, and it's always a soft tissue back injury.
Yeah, except that Oregon law prohibits a person from being terminated because the complimenting or the employer knows about or the worker has filed a claim.
Exactly my point, sir.
I think what I'm hearing here is it's that the injury is not reported until the day before or the last day of work after they've been given notice that their work will be terminated or their employment will be terminated on a specific date.
Yeah.
So,
Mr. Chair, the literature does reflect that that does occur at times.
Yeah.
So.
Senator Wissett, did you have any questions?
Just to reiterate what Senator Plyer was saying, it's pretty common practice, and workman's comp pays better than unemployment does.
Okay.
I would just like to add one comment. These studies that Annette refers to do not involve discrimination because we don't believe that there's ever been a study on this issue. They're talking about other studies on other subjects.
Okay. Thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
JL, would you like to come up, please? And also, Mr. Shaw's not come back in, but he's the only other one we had on the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with NFIB and also co-chair of MLAC. NFIB doesn't take a position absent an MLAC position, so we'd be neutral on the bill. I think that we'll have this scheduled for Monday for a vote in our committee. But just to let you know the context of this measure, and admittedly, I think this might have a higher hill to climb on the management side. In the context of all the studies that have been proposed this session, there are four that I know of. I think at least three of which, or maybe all of which, draw from the worker benefit fund. So this is not a standalone study.
Okay.
The chiropractic study is also, House Bill 2588 proposes $200,000. There's a study to study the assigned risk pool and whether employers are unfairly being booted into the assigned risk pool or the composition of the assigned risk pool. There's also a study proposed on the effects of denials in the workers' comp system and what cost shifting takes place. To be honest, from a management side, out of those four studies, this would probably be last in our priority queue in terms of Senate Bill 194. I think we're interested in the chiropractic issue. I think we're interested in the assigned risk pool in terms of gathering data that you can actually make a solid conclusion from that would make our system better. That's just from our point of view, so you know. We do question the data set that would come about from this study and what use it would be down the line. Say you got information that was in line with the Texas study, what would you do with that? Would you make unlawful discrimination more unlawful than it currently is, or is the consequence to say that the bully needs more funding to investigate this type of thing? I'm not sure you need a study to come up with the conclusions that we're probably going to come up with, so I would just question the data set. Going back to the studies, you do see there's about $1 million worth of studies right now that I alluded to. That worker benefit fund, I think from both labor and management side, we are afraid is fast becoming a slush fund for any pet project that anybody wants to use because it's quote-unquote other funds. I pay 1.7 cents per hour as do my labor colleagues, and it does collect a sum of money, most of which goes into the fund. I think it's called the Retro Reserve Fund that makes up for cost of living adjustments for people who've gotten awards in years past. When the cost of living eats into those awards, the large chunk of the worker benefit fund actually goes to make up the cost of living differences year after year for those awards. Now, just to say, I would be cautious if I were you, because the worker benefit fund is becoming a slush fund for every project, every study, and it's something at some point you've got to say we got to draw the line somewhere. So I don't know if it's before 194 or after 194, but you know, there's roughly $1 million worth of studies that have been proposed just this session alone coming out of the worker benefit fund, and I want to establish that context for you.
Right. Mr. Wilson, I think one of the questions, if MLAC is going to be looking at this on Monday, Senator Byer brought up the question regarding where the study should be done. Could you just run that past MLAC as to whether that is something that MLAC would want to weigh in on as to, one, I guess, within a department, and if so, which department, or whether it should be something that's done outside? I just think that that'd be interesting to know.
Sure, and I can say, you know, back in my first term, back in 2000, we actually contracted out with a guy, I think, named Ed Walsh on our major contributing cause study. He was from Michigan State, and I think that was the most useful study we've had in my entire term. It's something we contracted out to him, and I don't think it was $300,000 a biennium. So I'm happy to bring up that question, because that's certainly fair game.
Great. Any other questions for Mr. Wilson? Thank you very much. I'm going to ask, is there anyone else here that has not given testimony on Senate Bill 194? I had, like I said, John Shaw. Apparently he's decided not to support. He was listed as a person in favor, so we had no opposition at this point, and we understand that MLAC will be looking at this on Monday. But that said, is there anything else that we need to go over?
That's it.
All right, colleagues, thank you very much. We'll close the Senate Committee on Commerce. And guess what? We've got 2 hours. Get under the cameras and, you know.